I remember one of the great realistic Christmases that I had in my past experience. Now, Lee, don't start looking at that. Now, this is a fine time to start checking record labels. I remember in the vast storehouse, that rag bag of memory, that great cluttered basement, that great cluttered coal bin of existence back there where all the mice have played and all the old tennis shoes are stored, I remember a man. I'm going to describe to you tonight a man who probably more than any other single man played a great influence on my life. And it was not a teacher. I don't think that the official people in our lives really play as much a part of our life as we like to pretend. By official, I mean parents, mothers and fathers. Because when you approach a mother or a father, you're approaching them with a very different view than you approach any other human being. There's a cloud between you and your mother and father. They're the mother and the father, you know. Teachers are the same way. But do you ever recall the first adult who really introduced you to the life the way it is? Well, let me tell you about this. There was a time when I can tell you exactly how old I was. I was 14 years old going on 15. And it was Christmas vacation coming up. Now, when you're a freshman in high school, Christmas vacations in the Midwest consist of 2 weeks. Now, they are looked forward to like no other period of the time of the year, even including summer vacation, and for a very good reason. It is sometimes unbelievably cold in the Midwest, especially around Christmas time. And, of course, at Christmas time, there are all kinds of things going on that certainly don't go on in the summertime. There are thousands of various games that kids play out there. For one thing, we were inveterate hockey players. Do kids around here, Ed, play much hockey? Did you? Upstate. Well, I said, did you play much hockey? Yes, good, fine. Well, then you know what I mean. It really gets kids right where they live, male kids. Do you know that up until the time I got out of the Army, I had never ice skated on a rink, on a regular rink, that we skated on the swamps out there. We skated also on the river, the Calumet River, which wound about, three-quarters of a mile or a mile away from where all of us lived. And when you're ice skating in the river, you have unbelievable problems that you probably don't know about if you get all your skating down here at Rockefeller Center. For example, I don't know whether you have skated hell-bent for election, if you can excuse the expression, around the goal and suddenly found yourself knee-deep in cattails, going like mad and about 400 miles an hour into the cattails and knowing that you're heading for very, very scary water that is going to go out from under you. And you're struggling, fighting, grabbing the cattails. And they holler, hey, ship's going into the cattails. Ah! And then finally you get yourself stopped and you pull yourself out, because in the cattails the water is right under the surface, because the cattails, due to the fact there are so many of them, prevent the ice from freezing solidly. So it's very, very scary. Well, this, I don't know, ever happens at Rockefeller Center or at the Woolman Arena. I don't know whether anybody ever gets caught in the cattails. And about every third or fourth day, some kid would literally go right in, pow, right into the river, that black water with the catfish. He would go into the river, and we'd haul him out, and everyone would have to rush home, take him on the Elgin bikes home. He's freezing solid. He's absolutely spread-eagled, you know. We'd take the kid home. The temperature is 5 below 0, and you freeze quick. And say, here, Bruner fell in the river. And you push him in the house, and you go back out playing hockey. That's the end of it. That's the end of Bruner. And that was the way we played hockey. Well, the big deal, of course, was Christmas vacation. Well, when you're going through the Holden Caulfield period in your life, you get hung on chicks, really hung on chicks. And chicks play at that period in your life a very different role than they ever play ever again afterward, although some guys never can quite shake it. I know one guy who's never really shaken it, so he's taken the growing beards. He figures that's one way to hide. Well, one thing that chicks have on you in that period, which you, as a male, you must admit, males, they never quite outgrow, nor do you, is that chicks have an infinite air of indescribable mystery about them. You know what I mean, Ed? He just sort of nods. Yeah. Yeah. It's a kind of mystery that is on one hand extremely exciting, and yet on the other hand you prefer to ignore it, because you think it's because of some sickness in you that this is occurring. And so You get all excited and all hung up with hockey and stuff like that, you know, fist fighting and hollering, falling down the steps and all that sort of jazz. Whereas actually there's always something else going on behind in your mind. And, well, anyway, to make a long story even more drismy, there was this girl. Her name, it doesn't matter, but I was really hung. I'll tell you, I was hung up. Now, I pretended all the time when I was going over to her house that I was coming over to see her brother, who was some years older than me and who figured I was somewhat of a fink anyway because I was much younger and, you know, I was a fink. So I'd come over there and I'd pretend like I was going to see him. Well, actually, I'd say, oh, no, no. They'd say, well, Johnny's in the basement. I'd say, well, I'll sit up here in the kitchen for a while and warm off a little bit before I go down the basement. Is Dorothy around? And, well, pretty soon she'd come out and, you know, it's in the kitchen. Well, these people were Swedish. Now, again, I must report that the Swedish influence in the Midwest is far greater than it is here in the East because the Swedes and the Norwegians, large numbers of them, moved out into the Middle West all the way ranging from Indiana through Wisconsin up through, of course, Minnesota and the Dakotas. There was a great, oh boy, what was that great book by Rolvag about the Norwegian farmers up in the upper Midwest. I would recommend you read it because it had a terrific influence on the Waves of Grass? Sea of Grass? I believe, no, that's Willa Cather. Giants in the Earth. That's it. If you ever get a chance to pick up a book, which once in a while pops up in crossword puzzles, written by a man named R-O-L-V-A-A-G, Rolvag, called Giants in the Earth. This is about Midwestern winters in the very early days. Of course, it isn't quite that way now, nor do I ever pretend that the Midwest is pristine. It is not. I don't want you to have an idea that this is true. However, it is geographically different from the way it is here. And they do have giant winters, and they do give you a whole series of problems that you don't face here in the East. Well, the Swedes loved that climate out there because it reminded them of Sweden. It reminded them of the frozen north. And so people almost always gravitate to the areas that remind them most of the country that they came from. For example, all around Cincinnati, they have a whole area called the Rhineland. Over in the Rhineland, they're always saying, was you in Cincinnati? I was down there one time in the Rhineland. Well, now that, at one point, Cincinnati was composed of over 50% pure Germans right out of the Rhine area because it looks exactly like the Rhine country around Cincinnati. Yeah, great towering hills and dark forests, and there is a quality of the Rhine, and it is called the Rhineland. Well, up in northern Indiana, because of the flat area there and the great sea of water, that frozen body of water known as Lake Michigan that never quite unfreezes, this reminded many Swedes in the early days of Sweden. And so they came there and they settled there. So the Swedish influence is very strong. And it's a very interesting influence. There is, at the same time, there is a peculiar mysticism and a strange kind of fatalism that is right out of Ingmar Bergman. Anybody who sees Bergman around here in New York are constantly amazed, but Bergman really does come out of a whole way of life and a whole view of life that is shared by almost all Swedes. He really does. And this was the first actual influence I ever had outside of my family, outside of Bolus Rakowski, outside of Geza Nemeth, whose mother once tore my shirt right off, screaming Hungarian gypsy oaths at me. And I'm always hollering at her, Enem Tudum Tashik, and she tears my shirt up. This is a wild crew. So I am now in the middle of a Swedish household. And I was getting inured to a new life. And of course, I didn't know it. All I was hung on a chick. And she was a lovely blonde girl, a typical Swedish girl that you see pictures of, and she could have stepped right out of a Bergman movie, that strange icy blue quality with the high cheekbones, the rapier-like look, you know, at the age of 13 yet. I'll tell you, it was scary. So here I am, see, and the father in this family was sort of like, you remember how Edmund Gwenn looked? A little short, fat man with round cheeks, with vaguely fuzzy, curly, blonde hair that was thinning, and a look a sneaky look as though he was always under his breath laughing at everything that happened. I couldn't understand this, you know. I really couldn't. He would look out. He would just sit there across the table from me and look, a little short, hefty, angry, drunken carpenter. Now, it is almost axiomatic that all carpenters I've ever known, because of the fact they are carpenters, are angry men. They drink, like painters. Now, I'm immediately going to get 45 badly written letters from the painters with a heavy smell of beer about them, asking me, why do I say painters drink? Well, I don't know, painters. Look around. I have no idea. You're not the only ones. So don't feel badly about it, or bad, if you prefer better English. So anyway, here was this guy who was a tippler. Now, I wasn't really aware of that, because you never think of adults who are fathers of chicks that you're hung on as really being malevolent. He was really malevolent, and he was not discouraging me as a kid. He was encouraging me. He kept looking at me, in effect saying, go ahead, son, try your hand. And I'm 14, see, and Dorothy would come into the room looking like this thin blade of wildly animalistic femininity right out of a Bergman movie, and it was going out of my skull. I'm telling you, Fleischmann's yeast was coming out of every pore of me. I was sweating Ovaltine, cold sweat. So I'm sitting there, and he's looking at me all the time with those china blue eyes, and he had this tall, thin, fascinating wife. I'll bet there isn't one guy listening to me tonight who has ever known a genuine Lapman or Laplander. Well, his wife was a Laplander, and it was the only one I'd ever known in my life, and she had come over from Lapland at the age of 5. So she was just a Laplander, I suppose they call them, only in the fact that she had been born there and had grown up in a Lapland family, and all of her family was still back in Lapland. You know, there's only about 2,500 Laplanders. Are you aware of that? They, let me tell you, they are as rare as whooping cranes. And she was a Laplander. Well, she would stand hovering over her stove looking. Did you see the virgin spring? Believe me, this struck home to me. Did you ever see anything by Carl Dreyer, like Odette, the great Danish director? Well, this woman was right out of those films, a tall, dark-haired woman. She was about 2 feet taller than her husband, with high cheekbones, pitch-black hair, and a kind of brooding-like eagle look. You know, they hunt in Lapland with eagles. Are you aware of that? Yes, they train eagles to hunt, and I'll never forget one time seeing a movie that was filmed in Lapland of a bunch of Laplanders out hunting with their eagles, and the eagles chasing the wolves over the ice. I'll tell you, that's a sight you don't quickly forget, even if you're only 5 years old when you see it. Well, this was that kind of woman, and she was always standing over the stove baking anise bread. Now, anise bread is a maddening. It's almost even by definition, an aphrodisiac. Do you know what is it, anise bread baked in the Lapland or the Swedish way? Well, it's kind of twisted, and it has a sweetness to it. And it has a sort of sensual mystique that even clings to it, just as it's given to you. And so she's always baking anise bread and making glug. Yes, that's G-L-U-U-U-U, umlaut, little funny things, little zeros, dots, glug. I don't know else how to say glug. Well, glug is made in fruit jars, and glug is drunk at Christmas time by angry Swedes who are wassailing it up. And they also eat a kind of fish that they hide out in the backyard under the ground until it gets moldy. That's right. They take fish, and they dig a hole in the ground, and they bury the fish. And then, after about a month or so, when the fish is ripe, when it is really ripe, they go out and dig it up and serve it like cheese with glug. Yes, oh yes. So, and I'm in the middle of all this, and of course I'm making the scene. I'm really making the scene. And my mother, of course, they didn't know nothing about this. I was just over there visiting these people, that's all, friends, who never had anything to do with anybody else in the neighborhood. That's another thing about Swedes. Oh yes, Swedes do not mix. They mix, believe me, less than many other European groups. And I was out there swinging, and this guy was a ham. He was a kid, and Dorothy was really a lovely girl. So I'm down there every day and every night. I'm living a Swedish life. I even learned all kinds of svenska polka words, I learned all kinds of Swedish phrases. And old man Anderson was coming in. He hit me on the back. He says, "Svenska." And I'd say, "Yeah." He'd say, "Svenska, klug." And I would say, "Yeah." And he would bring out this knee-high orange, what he would give me, and pretend he was giving me glug. And he would be drinking real glug, you see. And about 30 seconds later, he falls under the table, singing old barracks ballads that the Swedes sing. Well, so, it's a real gutty life. So I'm sitting there every day, and Mrs. Anderson is brooding over the stove. They had a great big stove on which she was always making these things, cookies and stuff. The Swedes are nutty for cookies. They mainline cookies, if I can be so bold. So she is hanging over the stove there with the anise going full blast. When old Anderson is sitting opposite me, he banged the table like this. "You're quite a kid, huh?" And I'd say, "Yeah." He'd just sit and look at me. And he had these bright blue eyes. And he'd say, did I ever tell you about the time I went always as a boy? I would go boating in a river, and we would make all ice skates go. I make my own ice skates." I'd look at him, and, "Is he putting me on or what?" And then he'd knock down another slug of glug and eat some more of that rancid fish. And Mrs. Anderson would moan quietly in the background, as Lapps do in the dark of winter, suspecting many a minute now that the iceberg is going to swallow him up and the Kodiak bear is waiting in the basement. "Oh, yes." And she'd go, "Oh." And I'd say, "Is Dorothy here?" And I'd hear a little rattling out in the next room. Dorothy was a typical Swedish girl. They both dig men and hate them. Interesting thing about Swedish women. Yes, indeed. There's a funny thing about them. And, yes. These are all generalities, but I have found them over my long period of existence that the hounds of hell live on generalities, and you'll die by them too, Dad. And so I'm sitting there one day, and Mr. Anderson, it's now coming up Christmas, and the glug bowl is really going hot and heavy. And he says, "Gin?" I says, "Yeah, gin." And I said, "Yeah." He says, "How would you like to work for me?" I'd say, "Work for you?" "Yeah, I'll see what kind of a boy you really are." And the funny, Swedes almost always talk as though like they're being played backward on a record player. And so I said to him, "Well, yeah, fine." He was a carpenter. And it was coming out to Christmas time. And in about 2 or 3 days, the big Christmas thing that I had looked forward to was to start. You know, we were going to play hockey, and we were going to swing. We were going to go into Chicago. I was going to buy a Christmas tree, and the whole thing was going to happen. We were going to visit Uncle Charles and Aunt Glenn and Uncle Tom and everybody. It's the big thing of the year. Remember that. There's that little excitement going on all the time. He says, "How would you like to work for me?" Well, I said, "Fine." Because, you see, my eye was on Dorothy. This is something, kid, you're going to learn about women. That many a guy sells himself down the river not knowing why he has done it. I am rationalizing, thinking what I ought to do is get the dough, and then I'll be able to really buy stuff for Christmas, see? I'll work for Anderson. Little realizing that one of the great moments of my life is about to begin. So Anderson said, "Yeah, it is all night work. Work. Night work." This is the way they say it. And I said, "Well, night work, gee, I thought that's great. Then I'll be able to fool around and swing all day long. You know, I can be able to play hockey all day, and then at night I can work." "Yeah, it is night work. Night work. After the music comes shushing." And so I said, "Well, fine, when do we start?" I'll start. He says, "We are going to put in a new ceiling at the drugstore." I said, "A new ceiling at the drugstore? Yeah. All night we start on Saturday." And I said, "Saturday night?" "Yeah." Well, I'm very excited about this. Well, Mr. Anderson was a short man who I had never once seen, except on one occasion when he attended a funeral that I happened to be there at. I had never seen him out of his blue overalls, the kind that have the straps that go up over the back, and a blue work shirt with a blue bandana that stuck out of the back. He wore one of these heavy Sears Roebuck black, what they call a melton cloth mackinaw. Have you ever heard of a melton cloth mackinaw? That's one of these dark blue mackinaws of a heavy, thick, fuzzy felt-like wool that was lined with corduroy. He wore that summer and winter. This is the way with carpenters. And he also always wore a corduroy hat that had a big bill sticking out in front when he was working. And Anderson was bristling with hammers and stuff sticking out all over him, hammers and things. And he, believe me, if there was ever any man that I ever knew, I have ever known, who could do anything, absolutely anything, old man Anderson could do it. He was a totally unafraid man, completely unafraid, and it showed in his eyes, and it made me scared. I could not imagine why I was always vaguely afraid of this man, because he was always amused. There was always a slight smile playing around his lips. Do you know the smile of the magician in Bergman's movie? That vague smile, and yet his eyes are saying something else? That's the way this man always was. Well, everybody in our place, I mean, if they wore plates, their eyes were plates. You know, if they wore false teeth, they had false eyes. They also had false brains, everything. They were absolutely exactly what they were. Aunt Glenn was what Aunt Glenn was. She was fat, a human tomato pincushion. That's all she was. Aunt Clara was sort of Zazu Pitts. Aunt Clara would always cry. That's the end of it. She would cry. Yeah, anytime there would be a loud noise, Aunt Clara would cry. She was the pitiful aunt. We have, you know, everybody has a pitiful aunt. Well, we had a pitiful aunt who was kind of pale and who cried and who was always to be counted on when there was a funeral. She organized it. Aunt Clara was, and so everybody was what they were. They really were. But old Anderson was not. It was my really first, absolute first influence with the great Northern European cultures. Most of us here in New York are influenced by the Mediterranean cultures. We really are. We're influenced by the Mediterraneans, by the Italians, by the Middle East. Very few of us ever really come into contact with the Swedes in their natural habitat. Well, here was Anderson, great storm clouds always playing around his head. And he was, I could not understand him most of the time because he would get abstract. He would say to me, like I'd come in, see, and I'm swinging, I'm hollering, I'm yelling, and the ice skates are flying, I want to see Anderson, I want to see Dorothy, and everybody. I come in, and he'd sit down, and he's drinking the glug, and he'd say, "You really think you're happy, don't you?" And he's grinning. I'd say, "Well, yeah." I'd say, "Well, that's right, you're happy." I'd say, "Yeah." "Is Dorothy here?" "Hi, Mrs. Anderson." I would hear coming from the direction of that dark cave where the stove was, where you could smell the anise. Mrs. Anderson was again being pursued by a great pack of wolves over the ice sheets. And she'd look at me. Her eyes, deep black sockets, burned into the snow. Yeah. I'd say, "Hey, Dorothy!" And then I'd hear rattling. She never came out. She was always in the next room. That's the way it is with Swedish girls, man. They're always in the next room. And so Anderson took me down to the drugstore on a midnight night, dark in a December many eons ago, with the snow falling thick and fast 1 week before Christmas, and the spirit of Yuletide on me. Well, I don't know whether you have spent all night in a deserted drugstore surrounded by Coca-Cola signs, Piruna signs, and Triple S blood tonic signs, with a vaguely drunken carpenter up on the top of a rickety scaffold tearing down old sheets of tin that had been put up in the 1880s. And every time I tear a sheet of tin down that had been put in this old drugstore, you know, it was one of these ceilings with the pressed tin with the flowers and all that that had been painted over 19 times. And my job was to rip them down. And he's following me, putting up the Cellutech stuff with the holes, see? And I'd go, "Ooh!" And down would come 14 dead rats that died in the great winter of 98. Oh! And the bats would fly away. And then I put it down. And then I go, squeakings. And Mr. Anderson is chuckling. He is chuckling in Swedish. Swedes even have their own way of laughing. Well, about 3 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Anderson said, Well, shall we wait for some, just a little refreshment? So what will you have, Coca-Cola? And I said, yeah. So he jumps down and he makes a Coke at the counter, in a dark counter, feeling like you're really stealing, you know, there's a wonderful feeling about that. And he whips out of his lunch bucket a ball jar with a rubber gasket around it of glug. And down the hatch went about a half pint. And he ate a dead fish that had been dead since August. He ate a dead fish and knocked down about a half a pint of some kind of strange liquid cheese with green worms in it. And, yep, that's the truth. And he kept offering it to me, see, and I got my salami sandwich. Well, immediately after that, Mr. Anderson started to tell me Swedish dirty jokes up on the top of the scaffold. And I'm standing up there, and I go pulling the thing down. He said, and then, what do you think the traveling salesman said to the girl outside of Stockholm? Oh, I must stay. And I'm getting, it's a fantastic nightmare. And he's laughing. Well, about 5 o'clock in the morning, Anderson fell right off the scaffold in between the counter where the Coke machine was and the back place where the glasses are. And he didn't move. He's laying there. He fell off, and it's in this dark drugstore, and I don't know what to do. Well, the only thing I could do was to call Mrs. Anderson. So I dial the phone, and I call her, and I hear this Lapland voice. Hello. And I said, Mrs. Anderson, Mr. Anderson fell down behind the Coke counter, and well, he's sleeping, and I can't wake him up. She let him sleep. He'll wake up in about an hour. Has he had his lunch? And I say, yes. Does he have the green jar? Yes. Well, in about an hour, he'll wake up. So I climbed up on the top of the scaffold and sat there. And I'm sitting there. And I'm looking down in the darkness. And laying there right below me, lying on the ground, on the floor of the drugstore, surrounded by Coke bottles and old Pepsi-Cola bottles, is a drunken Swedish carpenter with a strange, cynical smile on his map. He smiled like that when he was asleep. And then, after exactly 1 hour, he stirred and says, get to work. He looked up at me, get to work. He started to laugh, and that was the beginning of an education.